This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Astronauts Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley will have to wait a little longer to blast off into orbit.
And Dragon SpaceX, unfortunately, we are not going to launch today. You are go for 5.100 launch scrub.
Bad weather delayed the launch of their historic mission yesterday, but when they do lift off, they'll be the first astronauts in nearly a decade to launch from US soil. NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine said he knows there's disappointment about the scrub, but he said it was still a great day for NASA and SpaceX.
I think our teams worked together in a really impressive way, making good decisions all along. So here in this particular case, we had just simply too much electricity in the atmosphere. There wasn't really a lightning storm or anything like that, but there was a concern that if we did launch, it could actually trigger lightning.
The next launch attempt will be made on Saturday, weather permitting.
So what does this mission mean for the next generation of astronauts and for American aspirations to explore the far reaches of space? What impact did the pandemic have on your plans to watch this historic launch? We're taking your comments and questions on Twitter at WMFE Orlando, and we're live with space reporter Brendan Byrne and UCF planetary scientist Addie Dove. Brendan and Addie, thank you so much for being here.
Great to be here, Matt.
Happy to join.
Well, Brendan, I want to start with you. The two astronauts were strapped in and ready to go, but the clock was stopped just minutes before launch, and weather had been looking pretty sketchy all day. So is it unusual to have a scrub that close to launch?
This time of year, not really. Weather, as we know, is pretty bad and pretty sketchy, and things can change pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Usually, we're used to having launch windows, right, where there's a certain amount of time that a rocket can launch into space before it gets scrubbed. So if there is some bad weather in the area, you can wait throughout the window. But this launch was special because it required an instantaneous launch. So Bob and Doug's spacecraft had to launch at this precise moment where the ISS was overhead at a certain point so they could catch up to it, which is why when they realized that the weather wasn't going to clear in time with only 16 minutes left in the launch, they went ahead and called the scrub. Now, the interesting thing is, had they had a little more time, we heard some launch managers say this, had they had just maybe 10 or 20 more minutes, the weather conditions would have cleared up and they would have been able to launch. But unfortunately, weather was not playing in the favor of SpaceX yesterday.
So how long are they actually suited up and sitting in that spacecraft for? Because it's a bit of a procedure to get them all kitted out and then strapped in and ready to go, right?
That's right. So their kind of suit-up procedure began around noon yesterday. They got to sleep in until 9 a.m., which anybody covering the launch yesterday didn't get to do that.
That's a luxury.
But they started suiting up about 12 noon, and they were brought out to the pad to get a chance to kind of walk around the launch pad, kick the tires a bit, and then they go up into the elevator and are strapped in. I believe the capsule closing was about 2:30 or 2:40 yesterday, with a launch scheduled a little past 4. So they were in there for a few hours. A lot of the stuff that's going on in there is they're doing some comm checks, making sure they can talk to not only Mission Control at the Kennedy Space Center Launch Center, but also to Houston, and also through a system of satellites that they use to communicate back down to Earth while they're en route to space. Mm-hmm. So there was that going on, and then about 45 minutes to launch is when they arm the launch escape system and then fuel up. Now, after the scrub, it took them a few more hours. They had to wait there before they could egress and head back to crew quarantine.
And I'm just kind of curious to know, what happens if one of them just really gets the urge to go to the bathroom while they're sitting in there? What can they do?
You know what? This is an interesting story. SpaceX has been very secretive about the bathroom situation on the Crew Dragon.
It looks like they've got room for a bathroom in there. It's pretty roomy inside, isn't it?
For a full bathroom in there, it looks like. I'm not particularly sure what the design is for these spacesuits, but in the shuttle program, they had high absorbency garments, which basically are diapers that they would use for ascent and descent. That they use it. it's just a few hours. My assumption is that the NASA would just say, hey, hold it. There is a bathroom facility at the launch site. So after they've gotten out of their vehicles that they were driving there, they can make, at least this was the case in the days of shuttle, you can have one more bathroom stop before you got into the spacecraft.
Mm-hmm. Addie Dove, you know, we're pretty accustomed to watching rocket launches here in Central Florida. What makes this one so special?
Yeah, we're very fortunate to be able to see a lot of cargo missions and satellite missions and things like that launch. But this one has humans aboard, right? So I actually moved to Florida in 2012, so I've never seen a launch with humans. So it's just that much more exciting to know that we're sending Americans, in this case, but humans to space from American soil. And it's also just one of those things that I think it's easier for a lot of people to make that connection, right? If you have humans on board, we saw the astronauts waving goodbye, saying goodbye to their families, and it's a very emotional thing, and we can tie into it a lot better than it's just, oh, it's some piece of hardware that's going up into space.
Yeah.
Although we also get very emotional about our pieces of hardware as they go to space. So.
Yeah, I mean, there's something that really grabs you about just watching a rocket go up. I mean, it's the kind of visceral experience. If you're close enough to sort of, you know, really hear it and sort of feel the shockwave, I mean, that's pretty special, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an amazing experience. And I've seen a few Falcon 9 launches from a couple different places now out there, and they're just spectacular.
Mm-hmm. Got a tweet coming in from Lawrence. He writes, press reports focused on the first return to space from U.S. soil since shuttle, but this is really the first time U.S. astronauts in a capsule have been sat on top of rockets since the last Saturn launched in 1975 on Apollo-Soyuz historic docking mission. So it's a good point, right? I mean, because the shuttle was a different vehicle. It was a lot different from the vehicles that had gone before it. So in some ways, this is kind of return to the past. Talk about that, if you could, for a little bit, Addie. I mean, it looks kind of similar to, you know, the Apollo spacecraft and the ones before that, the Gemini, et cetera. But it's quite different, right? I mean, the outward appearance is maybe the only thing that's similar about this particular vehicle.
Yeah, we've gone back to this sort of capsule design. So the whole idea behind shuttle was that it was this reusable plane for a space plane, right? But they've gone back to the capsule design and for both SpaceX and for Boeing. Part of that is because it's a proven design. It works, right? You commented earlier, I think, that this one is a little bit more spacious. So these are actually more spacious than the Apollo capsules were. And part of that is just the design that works. So we understand the physics behind it a little bit better. And also all of these capsules now are required to have crew abort systems, right? So they're able to pull the capsule away from the rocket if anything's going wrong during launch. And so there's a lot of those designs that are harking back to the Apollo days and previous before that also. But a lot of that's with safety, but it's also just sort of this works and it's effective.
Brendan, you've been reporting on this program you know for some time now, and that crew abort system test was the kind of the last stage before this part of the mission, right? I mean, every flight is a test flight, as NASA always says, but getting humans into that space capsule and blasting them off, that couldn't happen without testing the system that would allow the capsule to power away from the rocket if there were an incident.
Yeah, that's right. That was kind of like the last big milestone for the development of this, and it was really interesting to see. You know, the capsule is equipped with, they call them Super Draco engines, that will actually, in the case of an abort, will fire and actually push the capsule away from the rocket and get the astronauts to safety. Now, that's another reason why weather really played into this launch, is not only were mission managers looking at the weather at the space center, but also downrange under the trajectory of the rocket, because this SpaceX capsule can pretty much abort all the way up to the time it gets to space, which is a capability that the space shuttle didn't have, a capability that the Apollo Saturn V had at certain points during the launch. So basically, it had to make sure that, you know, the sea conditions underneath this rocket from, you know, Cape Canaveral all the way up to the coast of Ireland were clear in case Bob and Doug needed to ditch their ride and get back to the ground. So, mm-hmm. yeah, you're right. The capsule gives them that opportunity to do this. And I think we should say, you know, this isn't the first time NASA astronauts are riding in a capsule. They've taken rides on the Soyuz.
Sure.
This is the first time that they are riding in an American capsule since Saturn V.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with 90.7 space reporter Brendan Byrne, who's covering the return to human spaceflight from U.S. soil. Also joining us, UCF planetary scientist Addie Dove. You can weigh in with your comments and questions over on Twitter as well. We're at WMFE Orlando. Brendan, just back to the kind of design elements and some of the hardware. I mean, although, as we were saying before, it looks quite similar on the outside to one of the classic capsules, it's pretty different, right? And I'm sort of wondering, you know, if something were to go wrong, like could astronauts pull off an Apollo 13-style rescue mission with the kind of controls and systems that they have in these new spacecraft?
They do. The interesting thing about the spacecraft, when you look at it from the inside, there's these giant touch screens in front of the astronauts, and there's very few controllers. There's not even like a joystick like to pilot this thing. And that's because it was designed that way. It was designed to be autonomous, pretty much self-driving to get it into space and to the International Space Station and then back again. The abort system, the computer can trigger an abort, but the astronauts do have some control. They have an abort knob if they need to turn that and they think they need to get out of there. But they also can self-drive the vehicle, and that's one of the major things that they're doing on this test flight is Bob and Doug will actually fly this thing by hand when they get up to the International Space Station, and they do it via touchscreen. So it's definitely an interesting way to fly a spacecraft, right? You wouldn't think of it. You'd think of, you know, a joystick or something like that. Mm-hmm. But they've got a touchscreen to do it. And Doug has talked about how the transition to it was pretty seamless and how it makes sense. So they'll get to test that out. And if you go on SpaceX's website, they actually have the simulator that you can do in the web browser, in your web browser, using the same touchscreen controls that Doug and Bob will have, and you can see if you're able to manually dock to the International Space Station. I was able to do it, so I think I can go up on the next flight. So.
Congratulations, Brendan. That'll be the next step for us. Addie Dove, I mean, it's not just that the hardware and the technology behind the spacecraft, but there's some design elements which are quite interesting too, right? I mean, I'm just wondering what you make of that, not just the way the capsule looks, some of the sort of marketing around it, but also the spacesuits. I mean, there's mm-hmm. some kind of real pizzazz going into all of this. And does that help generate some real excitement for this new era of spaceflight?
Yeah, I definitely think the sort of futuristic, or at least one vision of futuristic look that they have for the spacesuits and for all of the design of a capsule will draw a lot of attention, right? So SpaceX has a very specific aesthetic they seem to go for. And then, right, the astronauts are driven out to the pad in a new Tesla model that's branded with NASA logos. I saw a good comment that was like, this is a great Tesla ad as it shows the cars driving out to the pad. but I think that it is very futuristic looking, right? And it's also very different than sort of the older view we have of astronauts going out to the pad. I find the suits, I don't know, the suits are interesting, but a lot of the aesthetics of like the walkway the crew uses to walk out to the capsule now, that I remember when they unveiled that, everyone was really blown away just because it looks very futuristic. And I think design elements like that are definitely going to get people interested and sort of bring some of these aesthetics back into it a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, it's more than just a test flight for this capsule, right? I mean, once those astronauts get up to the space station, they're going to be busy. What will they be doing up there?
Yeah, so astronauts up on the space station are scheduled pretty much 24/7. Part of that is sort of their own health and maintenance, right? But a lot of it is as space station maintenance, and then some of it is actually running experiments or doing different types of experiments and things like that that is up aboard the ISS. The ISS is actually a national lab currently, right? So there are active experiments, both commercial and through like industry, and then also academic experiments. We have hardware up there that we built for an experiment. And so they're scheduled. They have to do a lot of testing of the ISS itself, and then things like spacewalks and other maintenance inside of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking with UCF planetary scientist Addie Dove and 90.7 space reporter Brendan Byrne about the return to human spaceflight from the United States. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. What does the SpaceX Crew Dragon mission mean for the next generation of astronauts and for American aspirations to explore the far reaches of space? What impact did the pandemic have on your plans to watch this historic launch? That launch was scrubbed yesterday because of the weather, but NASA and SpaceX are going to try again on Saturday. We're taking your comments and questions over on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. And we're live with space reporter Brendan Byrne and UCF planetary scientist Addie Dove talking about the return to human spaceflight from the United States. Brendan, just thinking about spectators, I mean, there were pretty big crowds lining the roads in Titusville, according to eyewitnesses. And this despite NASA's advice to people to stay home and watch this one online. I'm just kind of wondering what that tells you about the level of interest in this mission and more broadly in space exploration.
Yeah, the public interest is extremely high for this one. You know, I wasn't able to see it, but I saw on Twitter and some, you know, we've heard from some of the staff at WMFE who live out there on the Space Coast just how crazy busy it was with traffic and whatnot. But yeah, it interest is really high. I mean, I was looking at the NASA TV YouTube stream, which is what NASA was asking people to watch the stream that they had there, and it was over a million viewers. I mean, that's awesome to see for a space flight. So interest is high. I mean, we can remember if you were here in Florida for the shuttle days, you know, everyone from, you know, all along the coast would line the beaches and watch this thing. This was kind of launching from Florida was in our DNA. That's what we did. We were the threshold to space, and I think now more than ever, people are so happy to see that capability and that prestige come back to Florida.
And Addie, I'm wondering too if people just kind of want a break from all the terrible news we've been enduring for the last couple months. I mean, we've been in the grip of this pandemic. People sort of want to take their minds off it and celebrate something rather than focusing on the dismal news that we've been focused on for so long.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, all of this coverage of the launch for the last few days and what it means for us, right, has been a nice counterpoint to a lot of the other news that's been coming out. And I think that, especially locally, right, people are excited about it. But as Brendan said, it's definitely people all around the country and around the world who are tuning in to watch this happen, because it means a lot to us, but it also means this space flight means a lot to people all around the world. So I think that having the virtual presence and having that many people logged in watching is huge.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Addie, if we could, about what commercial crew this program means for science and the bigger picture of space exploration. I mean, what have we been missing out on over the last 9 years by not having the ability to send astronauts into space from Florida or elsewhere in the United States?
Well, as Brendan mentioned, we have been sending astronauts via Soyuz, but it's a limited crew that we can send up that way. By having a couple of other sets of vehicles, we can potentially send more astronauts to the space station, so sort of have a larger crew complement up there. They can only have enough people that they can bring back. So you have a Soyuz that can hold three people. Could only have three to six people up at a time. And so it potentially can make a big difference with how many people we could have up on space station running experiments, doing long-duration human spaceflight studies, which is a lot of what they've done. But also I think it speaks to the fact that NASA now has this commercial partner that they're doing, and they are going to be having SpaceX and other companies potentially fly to low Earth orbit, but also that they're using this as a as a precursor to what's going to be happening with the lunar missions, right? So a lot of the lunar architecture is built upon purchasing vehicles and landers and things like that from companies and having them really drive the design. And that's a huge step for NASA, but it's this sort of new future where there's all this partnering that you're doing with commercial companies.
Yeah. And to that point, Brandon writes in on Twitter, what's a realistic ETA for manned moon missions from the space coast? Could it be SpaceX? Thanks for your question, Brandon. Addy, what do you think about that? What sort of timeline are we looking at here? Or is that a little bit unknown at this point?
So the NASA stated goal for lunar missions, right, is 2024 to have humans land at the south pole of the moon. There's some up in the air about what exactly which vehicle they're going to be going on and things like that. But they have been making a lot of commitments in terms of landing vehicles that they're going to be using more recently. So there's been some advancement in that. And so they're definitely pushing the architecture forward as fast as they can, I think. And we'll sort of wait to see if it's going to be 3 to 5 years-ish before we have humans going to the lunar surface.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, we're talking with UCF planetary scientist Addy Dove about the return to human spaceflight from U.S. soil, what that means for science and for the broader aspirations of the U.S. space program. You can reach out with questions on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. We're also joined by 90.7 space reporter Brendan Byrne, who's been covering this story for the last little while and pretty busy this week. Brendan, as Addy pointed out, you know, the Commercial Crew Program isn't the only new thing happening in the world of space exploration. What else does NASA have in the hopper for deep space exploration? And how do you see companies like SpaceX, Boeing, even maybe something like a Virgin Galactic fitting into that?
Well, as Addy mentioned, you know, NASA is working to put humans on the moon. When that will happen, we'll see. But one of the major components of NASA's moon architecture is the Space Launch System, the SLS rocket. And that's being developed and actually going through some final testing right now, the Marshall Space Flight Center, ahead of an uncrewed mission. But NASA is asking for private companies to help design the major elements to its Artemis program. So there's, you know, the SLS rocket, its major contractor is Boeing, the Orion space capsule that's going to take astronauts into deep space that's manufactured by Lockheed Martin for NASA. And NASA just awarded 3 developmental contracts for different companies to build those human landing systems, the thing that's actually going to get them from the capsule all the way down to the surface of the moon. Mm-hmm. Some interesting names on the list. SpaceX was actually awarded a development contract of its Starship rocket, which is this kind of steampunk-looking sleek. Steampunk chic, we'll call it. Starship. That's a single-stage lander, which is very interesting. There was an organization led by Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin is developing a multi-stage lander, and there was another company as well that was awarded that. So they've got about a year to develop a plan to build this lander, and this lander needs to be ready to go by 2024 to land humans on the moon for that charge. So you know, those private companies are kind of fueling NASA's deep space ambitions, and with SpaceX, they have their own kind of, you know, their own ambitions to go to deep space. If you talk to Elon Musk, he says that's the sole reason they founded SpaceX. All the work that they're doing now is so that they can develop the capability to colonize Mars. So there's these very ambitious thinkers like Elon Musk that are doing that, but they're also helping NASA with its own deep space ambitions.
Yeah, and sort of thinking about that timeline, I mean, when you consider just how many advances have been made, and especially SpaceX, the ability to launch and reuse their boosters on, you know, remote ships out at sea, that's pretty phenomenal stuff. They've kind of come up with the technology to do that, developed it, and now that's, you know, that's just something they do on a regular basis. Does it seem like some of their plans outside of NASA, we will be seeing those come to fruition fairly soon?
Absolutely. I mean, SpaceX is just kind of pedal to the metal with development at this point. I mentioned Starship, which is that sleek-looking, you know, heavy-lift rocket and spaceship. Mm-hmm. they put it on pause right now, but they're doing engine tests of this thing out in their launch facility in Boca Chica, Texas. They had this, it was, we coined the term the water tower. It looked like a stainless steel water tower. They stuck an engine to the bottom of it, and they got it to fly and land. They're doing some really, really interesting development of their new hardware, and it's working. And the thing that SpaceX lives by is you fly, you fail, and then you retry. You know, they want to push their technology to the brink, and that's how they're able to develop so fast. And really, it's been this exponential pace at which they are developing some of this rocket technology. It's just incredible to watch.
Mm-hmm. Jason writes in, how long will the astronauts be on the space station, and when is the next launch window if the weather doesn't cooperate on Saturday? Addie, what do you know about just how long those two astronauts are going to be up there on the space station?
That's actually a really interesting question, because we actually don't know. So the I think the minimum mission is about a month, which is sort of what they're planning on. But they're saying that it could go longer than that, and that's going to depend on things like how the Dragon behaves when it's up there for that long. So they're going to be monitoring things like its solar panels and other functions on the Dragon when it goes up. But the astronauts could actually stay up there for several months if they decide to. I think it was at first it was just going to be a relatively short mission, but they are now saying that they might extend it depending on how well everything performs.
Mm-hmm. Now, once
and then the next mission after that, there's not a launch date for it yet, but they are going to that's planned on being a longer mission.
Mm-hmm. And how does Boeing fit into that? Because their test flight didn't go so well earlier. They're kind of rescheduling that, but are we going to see that ship up and operational with humans on it fairly soon as well?
That's a good question. So Brendan can jump in, but I think that they still have to do another uncrewed test of that before they put humans on it. So that's going to be, I think that's still a bit of an open timeline.
Yeah. Brendan, what do you know about that?
They still have to fly that uncrewed mission again, which could happen this year. But yeah, they'll have to go through that and then receive their final certification for the human test flight. So yeah, it's a bit of a delay, and that's kind of why this mission has been extended, as Addie mentioned, for at least a month, is to kind of give the sole occupant up there, Chris Cassidy, a hand to kind of do some of that research that Addie was talking about and to do some maintenance on the station that they need. Bob and Doug both have gone through EVA training, so they can do spacewalks while they're there. Well, at least Bob can do spacewalks, and Doug can control the robotic arm. So they have an additional capability. It's not just going to be like a week-long test mission anymore. They'll be doing some real work up there.
Addie, you know, once the Crew Dragon is flying on a regular basis and the Starliner is operational too, what does that mean for the science that's being done on the space station? And does it give the space station a new lease on life?
I hope so. There's a lot of sort of back and forth right now about the space station and how long it's going to be extended. In terms of how long NASA is going to run it, there's been a lot of talk of commercializing it, so sort of starting to hand it over to commercial entities. And they recently signed an agreement for another commercial habitat actually to be joined with the space station.
Isn't Tom Cruise supposed to be shooting a movie up there too?
And then Tom Cruise is going up. I was actually reading through some of the language, and in one of the recent ISS utilization proposal calls that NASA put out, there is language that they can fly private astronauts, up to two private astronauts per month. I don't remember the per year or something like that. Mm-hmm. So there's actually language to fly private astronauts up to the space station. So I don't know if Tom Cruise is going up through that method or through a different one. But I mean, I think that's pretty awesome, right? To get a lot of visibility by having someone like that fly.
Yeah.
And that's And that's actually one of the great things about having more frequent and more access to station and all of the spaceflight opportunities that are coming online now with Blue and Virgin Galactic, is that more humans hopefully are going to be able to fly, and not just NASA astronauts, but potentially private astronauts as well.
Right. We're going to have to leave it there, but I've been speaking with UCF planetary scientist Addy Dove and 90.7 space reporter Brendan Byrne about the return to human spaceflight from the United States. I want to thank you both for joining us. Coming up, the pandemic has changed the way we do business, but what effect has it had on the legal system? We'll have a conversation with Orlando attorney Conti Moore when we return. We're back in a minute.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The pandemic has changed the way we do business, but what effect has it had on the legal system? What are the limits of online platforms like Zoom when it comes to holding trials and other legal proceedings? How do you hold a jury trial in the era of physical distancing and amid the fear of spreading coronavirus? And what do people who have to pay child support or have other court-ordered financial obligations do if they've lost their jobs? Like everyone else, lawyers and judges are figuring out how to operate in this new normal and planning for an uncertain future. Well, Conti Moore is a managing partner of Conti Moore Law. Thank you so much for joining us, Conti.
Thank you for having me.
So, the pandemic has really upended a lot of the way we do business, right? And when you think about the court system, there have been some significant disruptions in the last couple of months. From your perspective, how has the last couple of months been different, and what have some of the challenges been?
Well, the legal system, you know, it's a matter of you can't really go to court like you used to. You're not having in-person trials. You're not able to go to the courthouse and physically initiate a case. So it's changed in that regard. But if you are lucky enough to live in Orange or Osceola counties, I will say that our chief judge and the judiciary have done an excellent job of continuing to make sure that we have access to justice. So we're having trials, hearings via Zoom. We are, you know, having case management conference handled via Zoom or telephonic. So in our counties, Orange, Osceola, they are really doing a good job of making sure that we're not just at a, you know, a halt. We're still able to move forward, still able to have issues addressed, and make sure that people aren't waiting for the end of this pandemic to get a resolution to their case. So we're fortunate in that sense.
How much of a challenge has that been, though, getting all of that up and running? Because, you know, I'm sure some circuits are maybe better equipped to handle kind of remote trials and those kind of conferences than others.
Well, in Orange and Osceola counties, it's been fairly seamless for the most part. It's more so just, you know, rescheduling and making sure that everyone has notice of how to click on the link for the Zoom hearing or the Zoom conference. That's a little bit of a challenge when you're trying to subpoena witnesses for a trial. You know, how do you make sure that they have access to the Zoom link for that trial? But, you know, for the most part, if you are, you know, good technology, you're able to navigate through that as an attorney. The courts, I was really impressed with our circuit here. They really, I mean, I think the courts closed down back in mid-March. Within a couple of days, I had a judge email me a link for WebEx for a hearing. I mean, we're fortunate. Some of the smaller counties I've heard have shut down and they're struggling. But if you live in Orange or Osceola counties, you know, you're in good hands as far as being able to still have your needs met as it relates to family law matters.
What can't you do? What has the pandemic put a stop to as far as you're concerned?
Well, initially, you couldn't go if you had someone that was indigent and they needed to file an indigent application to get their filing fees waived. Typically, you would have to go to the clerk of court and physically do that. I'm sure that seeing that since the pandemic's not really going away anytime soon, they will implement a way to try to help with that situation with people who are indigent. But at this point, if you can have access to a computer, you can file your case online. You can do all of that. So it's really not much that has stopped here locally as far as us having access to the courts and the clerk of court.
And as far as dealing with family law, I mean, some of the cases you're involved would involve kind of child support, people having to make payments and following up on that. How does that all work?
Okay, so that's what's a little bit tricky. The Department of Revenue has the ability to suspend someone's driver's license if they fall behind on child support. The other parent can also go to the Crooked Court and also request that that person's license be suspended if they're not current on their child support. Initially, what I was hearing from the Department of Revenue is that they were not suspending licenses. I'm not sure if that has changed yet or when that will change. So that's something that we're going to have to navigate is, you know, how do you deal with if you lost your job here and you work at Disney, right? And Disney's closed. How do we deal with that? How do we handle that situation? Because on one end, the parent's not in willful contempt. They simply aren't working because of the pandemic. And on the other end, you have a parent that needs that money to also help provide for their child. So it's going to be interesting to see how the courts handle that issue and deal with it. But in order to be held in contempt of court for your failure to pay child support, it has to be willful conduct, right? So if you're not working because of the pandemic, it's not willful. You didn't ask to be put in a situation. You're not trying to avoid your obligation. You just can't pay it because of the situation and what's going on.
And so do you get the sense that the court, the legal system has an idea of how to proceed with this, or do you think it's going to be a matter of trial and error?
I think it's going to be a little bit of trial and error. I think if you are a parent that's paying child support, what my number one tip for you would be not to bury your head in the sand. You need to be proactive. You need to file a motion. You need to request relief from the court saying, hey, this is what's going on. I don't have the ability to make a payment. Can you suspend my payments for 90 days, right? Or for 120 days? You can't just, you know, bury your head in the sand and think it's going to all go away. Another tip that I have that's really important, if you're paying child support, you need to make sure that you update your address with the Crooked Court. You want to make sure that they're sending notices about whatever they're going to do to the right address. When people move, they change it with the postal system. They update their address that way. They don't update it with the court. So it's crucial that if you're on child support and you've moved since your order was entered, that you update the information with the court so that they can contact you and you know what's going on with your child support case.
Do you have a good idea, Conti, of you know how many of your clients, if we're talking about clients who would be in the situation of having to pay child support, how many of them may be facing a situation where they've either lost their job or they're facing eviction? And granted, evictions have been suspended for the time being, but that deadline is fast approaching. You know, what's your sense of the kind of financial pressure that your clients are under right now?
A lot. I mean, we are, you know, people who worked at Disney, people who worked at summer camps, people who worked at daycares, if they weren't laid off, their hours were reduced significantly. So I'm hearing from a lot of clients, I can't pay my child support. I can't pay the alimony I was ordered to pay. And it's not their fault they can't pay it. But, you know, how do we make sure that we don't kick them while they're down or penalize them any further? Is the question. And so, and it's also, you know, this is the reason why people have to be proactive is because, you know, some people are going to try to take advantage of the system, you know, and take advantage of the whole pandemic and not make payments, even though they possibly could make payments. So the courts, you know, have to sift through all of that. But, you know, it's important that people are, you know, proactive, that they're being transparent with their finances and that they're, you know, taking the steps to protect themselves to make sure that, you know, they don't get kicked while they're down in this situation.
Are you expecting, I mean, thinking about the kinds of, you know, some of the things you've been saying, look, you have to make sure you're on top of this in terms of notifying the court if there's a change of address. Once the moratorium on evictions is lifted in June, are you expecting there's going to be a flood of people saying we've got to move because we're being kicked out of our apartment now?
I mean, yes, possibly. I can see that happening. That's, you know, you have to look at the landlord. Was the landlord able to get, you know, their payment suspended, you know, with the mortgage company? So it's like a domino effect, if you will, right? So, I mean, I can see evictions, you know, going up. I think it depends on the situation. It depends on, again, if the person was transparent or they're just trying to get over and use this, you know, as an excuse not to make their payments. So the court system is going to be just overwhelmed with trying to figure out what's what and making sure that they administer justice in all of the cases.
Do you think they're ready for it then? Is the court system ready for this?
I will say that the ninth judicial circuit is, we have amazing leadership. We have innovative judges. We have, you know, that really kicked into gear and made changes immediately. I can't say about every other circuit, but I practice primarily here in the ninth judicial circuit. And I think that they're ready. I know that they're ready to make sure that justice is administered fairly and timely. So we're fortunate. You're really fortunate if you live in Orange or Osceola counties.
I guess there's some limits to what a local, what a county circuit can do, though, right? Because they are taking direction from the state. So, what are some of the challenges there in terms of, if the Supreme Court of Florida were to say, well, we need to restart trials on this date, and that's going to be a problem for some circuits. Like, what are some of the workarounds?
Well, I mean, at least here, we're still having trials. Nothing has really stopped. Justice from moving forward here locally. So I have trials that are set for Zoom to be Zoom trials in November. So I think from what I'm gathering is that the courts, understand and the judges understand that, we're not going to be back in the courtroom anytime soon. Right. And so they're kind of planning. I think they're kind of planning and getting everybody, in place to handle virtual trials. And I guess if we can come back, maybe we will. But I mean, I do criminal law, so I'm interested to see how they will handle that as far as jury trials and how that will work. But I think that with social distancing, they're going to have to figure out, how do we have, people spread out in the courtrooms? How can it, how will it work? How do people use the elevators? I mean, there's so many issues that have to be figured out as far as logistics. It would be interesting to see what will happen. But I foresee criminal trials happening in person long before bench trials or family trials will happen in person.
If you're just joining me, my guest is Conti Moore. We're talking about the impact of the pandemic on the legal system here in Central Florida. That's an interesting notion, the idea of jury trials conducted by Zoom. To your knowledge, has one of those trials been done in the past? I mean, I know sometimes witnesses will be called remotely, right? But the idea of a jury assembling remotely seems like a challenge that might be a little hard to overcome.
I don't know if they can do that. We'll see. We'll see what will happen. The Supreme Court relaxed some of prior restrictions that they had. I mean, they understand it's a pandemic, and they've encouraged each circuit to figure out how to make things happen within their circuit. Like, for instance, for family law forms, they don't have to be notarized right now. You can put language in there and just sign it. I mean, they understand what we're dealing with. But I don't know how you handle a jury trial remotely. I don't know if they will, and if they will, how. For family law, we're having emergency hearings, trials, mediations virtually, depositions virtually. As far as the family law, I have a 2-day trial schedule in November to happen. It's going to happen via Zoom. So in the family law arena, nothing's really stopping what we have to do for our clients.
You were talking earlier about indigent clients. What kind of barrier is there in terms of access to technology, whether it's internet or even just having a phone? I mean, is that a challenge that you have to overcome too?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you absolutely have to overcome, that. If they can't, they don't have a phone or they don't have a computer, how do they even get the email to get the link for the Zoom meeting? I mean, those are things that we're working through right now. I know that some attorneys have met with clients that didn't have access to it, or they didn't have good Wi-Fi. You don't have a good internet connection. How is that ever, how is that going to work? So I know that some attorneys have clients coming to their office for the Zoom meetings or the Zoom mediation just to ensure that the technology is there. But I'm sure that, as we continue pushing through this pandemic, that we will figure out ways to make sure that those who can't afford the phone or the internet, they have access to the technology.
And is that something that you've done as well? Have you had to have clients come to the office, even though there is this pandemic in place?
Well, I haven't had anyone come to the office. All my clients have been able to use their phones or someone else's phone or their mom's, address to, get access to the internet. So I haven't had to do that. I've seen other attorneys have had to do that in mediations and in trials. So I think it's just going to depend on the situation. But I'm sure that, as we move through this and as we are kind of switching to the more virtual side of things, that we will have to all find a way to make sure that those who can't afford you know, internet or phones have access to court and justice. And I know in some cases, though, judges have allowed people to appear telephonically. So if you can just call in, even if you can't Zoom, if you just call in, the court will work with you in that regard.
The first time you conducted one of these, or you took part in one of these totally remote trials or hearings, was there a little bit of trepidation, like just wondering if the technology was going to hold up, or if some of these issues you've been talking about, like access to technology, were going to work? I'm sort of wondering what that process was like for you.
For me, it was pretty simple. We use technology at our firm. We've always used technology at our firm. So for us, you know, Zoom calls, sharing screens, that wasn't anything new for us. We do it anyway with our clients. But I would imagine that for some people, it is a little intimidating. I know, you know, with some judges, what's helpful is that they will actually, if you send them your exhibits beforehand, they will actually pull them up on the screen for you. So you're not really having to deal with, oh, how do I get it up there? Or how do I show it to the other side? They're helping with that. So the judges are really, you know, getting in here and helping us navigate through this so that people aren't as intimidated by the Zoom or the virtual hearing process.
Is there something though you might lose in the process of having a trial or a hearing remotely? Like, is there something kind of intangible that you gain from seeing somebody in person and sort of having that kind of personal contact?
I think that with virtual, because one thing, if you want to make sure that your client is, you know, that the judge can, you know, look at your client and kind of get a feel for who they are. I feel like on Zoom, when you have all of the screens up, it's the court is able to see your client even more closely now than they were before. Right? They're able to, like, there's no distraction. It's just you on a screen. So your body language, if you know, get upset about something, and, you know, they can see that more now than I think they could. If you're, you know, sitting a few feet away, you know, at a plaintiff's chair, or, you know, so I think that, you know, it's, I mean, objections, I mean, everything, it seems to be flowing pretty similar to how it was when you're in person. I think that these trials are more efficient, actually, if there are any issues with your exhibits, that these trials are more efficient. There is actually costing clients, I think, less, because it's not me having to drive to court, you know, walk in, sit and wait to be called. I can do other work until it's my time to make an appearance for your case. So I think it's actually more cost effective for some clients to have you appear telephonically. And I'm also able to appear in more counties, right? So it doesn't matter if it's in Florida, I can appear for a hearing versus me having to travel or, you know, do all that. So it's opened up, you know, who I can represent, who I can help as far as my business is concerned too.
And are you now representing people in different counties or people you wouldn't have before?
Yes, absolutely. So yes, I'm, you know, because it's me driving to Polk County now, it's, you know, I can just hop on a Zoom call and handle what I have to handle. So it's, you know, it's, I am able to help more people. It's besides just what's in, you know, Orange, Osceola, Lake, Seminole.
Just kind of thinking about the future then, I mean, to your point about the fact you've got a Zoom trial scheduled for all the way in November, and of course we don't know what situation the pandemic is going to be in by then, right? There are a lot of unknowns in this, but does it seem to you like there's, from here on out, there is always going to be some element or maybe more kind of remote elements to the work that you do than there would have been in the past?
Absolutely. I hope that the courts continue to use you know, the virtual platform. I think that, you know, for case management conference, for hearings, is, I think the judges are seeing, especially the old school judges, that, you know, doing it virtually is just as effective as if you were doing it in person. I mean, I hope it continues, that we continue to do this, because it's effective. I haven't had any major issues with a virtual hearing or a virtual trial.
I mean, you sound pretty positive about the future, and it sounds like you've kind of adopted this technology pretty seamlessly, but do you have some concerns kind of moving forward too? Like, can you see some things going wrong, or are you worried about any aspect of the future as we sort of move through this new normal?
I mean, you worry about, like, you know, the security part of it with Zoom, but it's my understanding that they've downloaded it, that you can, there's some more security things in place to help with that portion of it. But I mean, in a courtroom, anybody can walk into a courtroom and hear what's going on in a hearing. That, you know, so I mean, it's, I get that. I don't really have any major concerns. My concern right now is, you know, how do I subpoena these witnesses and make sure that they follow through a subpoena to appear for a Zoom trial? And so I know that, you know, some judges are saying, well, you know, have the person email the JA, the judge's assistant, by a certain date, and then the JA will send out the link. It's a matter of will people follow through on that? And if they don't follow through, will the courts follow through on punishing them for not appearing as if they were to appear like in person for a trial? So, I mean, that's something that I haven't had to navigate yet. But I would imagine that the courts understand that, you know, this is how we're doing things right now. So there has to be some consequences for those who don't follow by the rules or what the subpoena told them to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, Conti Moore is a managing partner with Conti Moore Law in Orlando. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Production assistance for today's show from Juan Gualda. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. When you donate right now to support WMFE, you're making all the news and information you rely on available for everyone free of charge. That service is just as important today as ever, and it starts with your gift. Visit WMFE.org to make your contribution, and thanks. Check out our Facebook Live show, The State We're In, produced in partnership with WUSF in Tampa. Next Tuesday, we're taking a closer look at the theme park economy, what reopening the parks means for people who staff and run them. Post your comments and questions and watch the show next Tuesday at 12 noon on facebook.com/statewearein. Follow us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando, and I'm at Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.